Firstly, a welcome to everyone. Thank you so much for attending the briefing, both our presenters and our various journalists and so forth. As you all know, today's briefing is going to be about dietary supplements. We're going to be looking at both the legislation and the science around some of the supplements and different types of supplements that are available on the market. A quick introduction for our speakers. First up, we're going to have Dr. Winsome Parnell, who is an associate professor in the Department of Human Nutrition at the University of Otago. She's currently involved in research in the area of children's nutrition and also food security, as well as being the nutrition director of the National Nutrition Survey of New Zealand Adults. Winsome's also supervised collection of data on dietary supplements and co-authored papers describing their use in New Zealand. Next up, we'll have Ian Hellemans. Ian is an accredited sports nutritionist as well as a registered dietitian. She was also a lecturer at the Department of Human Nutrition at University of Otago. She's also been a nutritionist for such teams as Triathlon New Zealand, the New Zealand Athens Olympic team, the Silver Ferns, and various cycling and swimming teams. Finally, we'll have Ursula Egan. Ursula works for the NZFSA and joined after a number of years working as a pharmacist both in pharmacies and as a professional advisor. A major focus for Ursula since joining the NZFSA has, of course, been the proposed change to the regulation of dietary supplements and the development of the supplemented food standard. Right, so now I'm just going to hand over to Winsome Parnell, who will begin today's presentation.
Thank you very much, Amy. I'm privileged to take part in this, and I've enjoyed the process and all the vlogging on. I've learnt new technology. Thank you. I have been privileged to be part of collecting data on samples representative of all New Zealanders through the National Nutrition Survey. We've just collected the 0809 sample. However, those data are not ready to be presented. You have to wait a year. So I'm going to start by talking about the prevalence of use of supplements, in other words, which groups of New Zealanders are actually using supplements in the data come from the 1997 survey. So yes, there will be some more up-to-date data, but these are the best data that we have. And so the first slide that's important to look at is the prevalence of use if you look over the previous year. So if you ask people, have you used dietary supplements in the past year? And for adults over 15 years, just over one half of men said they had done so, and two-thirds, or 67.6%, are women. Okay, now if you look at their if you say, over the past year, have you used supplements on a daily basis? 39.8% of men said yes, and 42.5% of women. Now, remember that people are thinking over quite a significant period of time when they answer that question. On the next slide, there's another way of looking at it, and so you just ask people to think back to the previous 24 hours. So, yesterday, okay, and for adults, 17.8% of men, 30.5% of women said that they had used supplements. So you notice that the prevalence is less than if you ask them back over the past year. But this is the, if you like, what's going on in people's lives. If you ask them about yesterday, it's pretty close to today. That's what's going on in their lives. So about 17.8% of men and 30.5%, almost a third of women, said, yep, we're taking supplements. Look at children, and these are children between 5 and 14 years, so it's not preschool children, okay, it's school-age children, and you'll notice that the use is considerably less, and there's not much of a male-female difference. So if mother said you will have a supplement, that was given to 5.9% of boys and 4.9% of girls. So that's not significantly different between the sexes. In terms of the kinds of supplements, I'm not going to give a great description of that except today to say that the type most commonly used are multivitamins and minerals, and they far outweigh any other kind of supplement that is consumed. On the next slide, We have checked to see whether different ethnic groups have differing or the same use of supplements. And if you fall in the group New Zealand, European and others, and that does include Asian groups because there were not a lot of Asians in our sample, they are more likely to consume supplements than New Zealand Maori or Pacific people. Then if you look in the adult cohort, those people 15 years and over, the younger group of adults compared to older adults were more likely to consume supplements. And then it's very clear that the people who consume supplements compared to the people who are not taking supplements have better nutrient intakes from food. In other words, the supplement takers have slightly better diets. That finding is clear in New Zealand, and the same finding shows up in the literature in overseas studies as well. And as I've already commented, and I'm sure you've noticed, women are more likely than men, it should be female versus male, to consume supplements. There wasn't much difference in sex difference for children, but with adults, women are more likely to be supplement takers. Then, are they good for you? That's a huge question, and I can't answer it in detail, but I can say that when you look at the supplements that New Zealanders are taking, you have to conclude that, in general, they're not necessary for those people to meet their specified requirements. So they're getting most of their nutrients from food. As I've already said, supplement takers tend to have the better diets, and those diets are fine. And if you're taking multivites, so you're adding extra thiamine and niacin, there was already plenty of thiamine, niacin, and usually riboflavin in the diet. However, there's a subgroup of people who take supplements who do need them, and usually they have been prescribed. So if people are taking an iron supplement, almost always a doctor will have said your iron stores, your serum ferritins are low, or your hemoglobin is low, you need to take iron. Or they will look at an older woman and say, you are at risk of fragile bones, you're not having a lot of dairy, I think you should have more calcium. Or they may say, you're living indoors and I've measured your circulating vitamin D's, they're low, I think you need a supplement. And in those cases, if there have been biochemical tests undertaken and a diagnosed need by a health professional, those people will need them, and yes, they will be beneficial. The self-prescribed bit is really a different question. Then, okay, do they do good? But are they safe or are they harmful? A very big question. Usually, if you take something like multivitamin mineral, even if your diet's fine, and you just take the amount recommended on the packet or the bottle, that will be safe because the amounts in the pill or little packet are of a reasonable level because, as Ursula will tell you, there are regulations about how much of vitamins and minerals you're allowed to put in a dose. So if they're taken in a specified dose, they're fine. However, a number of people say one is good, two is better, three is better still, not a good idea. Or, more likely, they all take a variety of supplements. They'll buy this one, that one, and the other one. And you may take a multivite and then decide, well, I've got arthritis, I'll take glucosamine. But read carefully, because as well as glucosamine in that particular capsule, you may also have zinc, iron, selenium, iodine, other things as well. And you may be taking those minerals from another pill that you're taking. So you get cumulative effects. If the cumulative effects are of water-soluble things, your urine will merely excrete them, does stretch your kidneys. However, if they are fat-soluble vitamins, They will not necessarily be excreted and may lurk around in your liver. Not good. If you're taking lots of minerals from different pills or powders, then at the gut level, they fight for the privilege of being absorbed. So if you're taking zinc from four different sources, poor old iron might miss out. Not a good one. So again, if you think that you can rely on pills and you can just make rotten food choices, you are getting into very poor practice and your health might suffer. And I wouldn't recommend that. So I think that's about all I had to say. I hope I've fitted in about five.
I'll start with my presentation. Is that right, Amy?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank the Media Science Centre for the opportunity to take part in this briefing. And Winston has already highlighted and discussed the prevalence of supplement use in the general population of New Zealand. And I'm going to talk more specifically about supplements for athletes. And in a recent survey carried out at the University of Otago, we found that 90% of a sample of elite New Zealand male and female athletes had used one or more supplements during the previous 6 months. So the prevalence of supplement use in athletes is very high indeed. And in some of our sports categories, supplement use was as high as 100%. All athletes that we surveyed in that particular category had used supplements. The most frequently category of supplements used by our particular sample was that of the supplementary sports foods. And for this presentation, I'll be focusing on that particular group of supplements. So what are sport foods? They are specially formulated foods to assist sports people in achieving specific nutritional or performance goals. They're intended to be used as an addition to the diet, and typically they are food-type products, powders, or liquids. And to just briefly come back to the specific nutritional or performance goals that are listed in point one, examples of these specific nutritional goals could be, for instance, carbohydrate loading to maximize energy stores prior to an endurance event, or consuming carbohydrates, sodium, and fluid during a prolonged event in the heat to prevent dehydration and depleted energy reserves, or consuming carbohydrate and protein immediately post-exercise for enhanced recovery. And there is good evidence that these nutritional strategies do enhance performance. However, it's important to understand, actually my slides are moving off their own volition. I'm not changing them. I'm going back to the previous slide. Okay. However, it is important to understand that some of these goals can be achieved by using normal foods, so it is not essential that a particular sports food is being used in some instances. And that's important to understand. So let's have a look at some examples of sports foods. And there are four main categories. The first one is that of sports drinks. Sports drinks are also called carbohydrate electrolyte or replacement drinks. And they are carbohydrate-rich fluids. They also contain sodium and potassium, and they are formulated for a rapid delivery of fluid and fuel during and after intense prolonged exercise, particularly exercise in the heat. They typically come in powder or liquid form. You may be familiar with some of the brand names such as Powerade, Replace, Peak Fuel, to mention a few. There is actually nothing in our normal diet that have the same composition as sports drinks. Therefore, these particular products can be very useful for athletes, particularly serious athletes, not athletes that perhaps go to the gym two or three times a week and down a Powerade during or before their session. They might not need this, but certainly the serious endurance athletes can benefit hugely from these drinks. And in fact, they can be quite important to prevent problems. The second category is sports gels. These are highly concentrated sources of carbohydrate in an easily consumed and quickly digested gel form. You may be familiar with them. Lipton Squeezy tend to be quite popular. Also, there are power gels. And they tend to come in individual packages. And they are used sometimes in addition to sports drinks or instead of sports drinks. And they are to be consumed with water. A third category of sports food is the meal supplements. These are also carbohydrate-rich supplements. They are moderate in protein and low in fat, and they are a substantial source of vitamins and minerals. So essentially, they are meal replacements, and they are a compact form of fuel and nutrients. They typically come in powder form, but they can come in ready-to-use liquid form as well. An example is Sustagen Sports. And then finally, the sports bars. These are, again, a compact source of carbohydrate, but also contain protein. They tend to be low in fat and fiber, but some can contain some fat and fiber. And they provide a substantial fuel boost during and after exercise. And in very prolonged events such as the coast-to-coast here on the South Island and other ultra-endurance exercise, they can be used to alleviate hunger as well during an event. So what are the situations in which these products can be used? Well, they provide easily digested fuel and fluid prior to and or during intensive exercise to prevent low energy and dehydration, and both low energy, depleted energy, and dehydration have an adverse effect on performance, and in fact, dehydration can be dangerous. Now, to put the use in this scenario in perspective, during a half marathon, if somebody runs a half marathon, all they need is a moderate amount of water. But once you start running a full marathon that can take up to 3-4, for some people 5 hours, you need to provide energy in the form of carbohydrate as well. Otherwise, people run out of fuel. And just to come back to the gym example, when somebody attends a recreational person who does exercise for fitness and health, goes to the gym three times a week, they don't really need to worry about boosting their energy levels prior to and maintaining energy during their gym session. Just water tends to be adequate. These sports foods can also supply fluid, carbohydrate, and protein to enhance post-exercise recovery. And this is particularly important for athletes like triathletes who train and swimmers who train twice a day and need to recover very quickly from their previous session in order to conduct an efficient subsequent training session. Also, these products can be useful to boost energy intake when needs are very high. Endurance athletes such as serious rowers, cyclists, triathletes, swimmers may train up to 4 hours a day, and they find it difficult to consume enough energy, carbohydrate, protein, from ordinary food sources. They basically just get too full. And for those people, a meal supplement, for example, can be very useful. Convenience is a main reason why these products can be used. They are a convenient alternative to normal foods and beverages, and for the athletes who travel overseas, they can be quite useful as well. So, what concerns are there associated with the use of these products? Well, first of all, an inappropriate replacement of whole foods. Some athletes, some weekend warriors use these foods instead of whole foods, and whilst these products provide some nutrients, they won't provide all the nutrients that we find in whole foods. The compact form of these products may lead to exercise energy intake and unwanted weight gain if they are used by people who don't really require them, who don't have these high energy needs. Again, the weekend warrior that goes to the gym a couple of times a week, or the recreational athlete. Thirdly, in some cases, people can suffer gastrointestinal intolerance due to the high concentration of nutrients. Some people find it difficult to tolerate the gels, for example, and the sports bars that can be high in carbohydrate and protein. There is a high cost associated with these products. A bar, a typical sports bar, costs about $5 per bar. You can buy a whole packet of healthy low-fat muesli bars for that. A gel, which has the equivalent amount of carbohydrate to one banana, one gel sets you back about $2.50. So there is a high cost with these products. And finally, but not lastly, but not least, some supplements have been found to contain impurities and prohibited substances. And this goes back to the regulation of these products that has not always hasn't been perhaps adequate in the past, and Ursula will talk more about that. But international research has found that some of the supplements available to athletes actually contain prohibited substances such that they could result in a positive doping test for athletes. And this is a huge issue for our athletes. And the buck stops with the athlete. Even if an athlete isn't aware that a product supplement may contain a prohibited substance, it's still their responsibility for taking it, and they will still be punished for taking a prohibited substance. So I'd like to leave it there. It's a quick bird's eye overview of sports foods, and I'd like to now pass on to Ursula.